Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. This week's show, we have a very, very fun interview with Bomani Jones of ESPN. We covered tons of topics, got into the NBA China thing a little bit and what it was like to be at ESPN for that. It was a memo. Apparently, hosts were told not to discuss politics, so Bomani pulled back the curtain a little bit on that. He talked about doing a high noon with Pablo Torre every day. We discussed Eddie Murphy. We discussed social media. We discussed many things. LeBron as well, Tyler Skaggs. And Bomani at the end shares his theory about Stevie Wonder maybe not being blind, which was a fun way to end the podcast. So hope you guys enjoy it. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with Bomani, so hopefully you guys too. You guys do too. Please download, subscribe, rate, review all SI Media podcast episodes. Helps tremendously. Last week, SI legal analyst Michael McCann was on the show, and we covered a lot of topics from the world of sports in terms of the legal angle, and it was very interesting to get into it with him. And we go right now to Bomani again. If you're not a subscriber, please hit that subscribe button. And if you can rate and review, it helps tremendously. All right, here we go. Bomani Jones on the SI Media Podcast. All right, joining me now in studio, which I always appreciate. Man has a lot of jobs. High noon, highly questionable sometimes. Not as much anymore, I know, with the other stuff. But the right time with Bomani Jones, the evening Jones. Bomani Jones is here. How are you?
Hey, man, I'm good. How about you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming down. Appreciate it.
No problem.
I mentioned your slew of jobs. I wanted to get you and Pablo on when High Noon debuted, and ESPN had said you guys were just focusing on the show.
Yeah, we were laying low.
Yeah, yeah.
We were laying a little bit low.
I didn't know if that was an ESPN PR thing or a Bomani and Pablo thing.
It was as much an Eric thing as anything else.
Eric went home.
Yeah, but at that particular time, we thought that it was better to get the show out before we started doing all this other stuff, right? Like what I don't think anybody wanted was for us to be evaluated based on what somebody quote-unquote expected rather than what it actually was. Because we were still, in a lot of ways, figuring out what it was actually going to be. So, you know, we want to put up a little bit of tape before we start going around talking about it.
Right. You feel like you guys obviously had the time switch from noon to 4. You went from 60 minutes to 30 minutes. You feel like you're in a good groove with it now. You're happy with it. Do you feel like there's still ways to improve?
Yeah, we're still tinkering, to be honest. Because the thing about the hour is not just that we had an hour. It's a difference when you do something at midday, right? So, like, when you do something at noon, whether it's TV or radio, you got a little more room to stretch out on topics. You've got a bit more flexibility in the ways that you can handle them. Now, of course, when you cut down the time, then it becomes a bit more just the facts sort of thing. But also when you're doing this at 4 o'clock, you got a different audience with a different set of expectations.
Right,
and so figuring out the best way to serve those people in that time slot is something we're still, you know, we're still figuring out the way to do it. The show's only been on now
a year and a half almost.
Yeah, a year and 3 months. Yeah, 4 months. Yeah,
June 4th, 2018.
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, this is still the early portion of doing something like this. Like, you go back and watch the Around the Horn episodes from the first year and 4 months, and they all want to burn those. Like, every single person that's associated with that wants to burn it.
Yeah. What's your goal for the show? What if it was up to you, what do you want the show to be?
I just
want
to be the best show that it can be. Whatever form that happens to take, right? So I think that in some ways, in our most kind of grandest, most ambitious sorts of outlooks, like, you know, it's like, oh, man, we want this to be the smartest show that is on TV. And I said very early, I was like, hey, man, the first thing they say about our show is about how smart it is. We are going to be failures. Like, there's no, like, that's not going to be the thing.
Because why?
Because that is, people are not coming to be wowed by our collective intellect. What they would like is for the intellect to power a certain level of analysis that then serves people in some very simple forms. But I don't want you coming away just being like, wow, those guys are smart. I'd rather you come away being like, wow, that show was good.
It's kind of funny you say that because when I was thinking about this interview, I think we met once before. I don't know if you remember. I had a Blogs with Balls.
Yeah, 2011.
And I remember it was my first time ever seeing you in person like that. You were on a stage. And I remember like, I'm like, this is a smart dude who I don't want to speak to because I'm so out of my element here. But it was, I remember just being blown away by what you were saying that day, sort of about, I mean, back then, like you said, 2011, I don't think, you know, Twitter wasn't what it is. The internet was still, you know, we're in a completely different place now. It's funny you say that about, you know, it's interesting because I do think we're in this thing, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, about stick to sports and the theory that sports fans, especially from your network, just want sports. But I don't know. I do think there's an audience who does want smarter coverage.
Yeah. And I think that most people do appreciate smarter coverage. And what I'm not saying is that anything we'll do will be at the expense of the intelligence, right?
Right.
But I think it is more important, or put it this way, you don't want to be like facetiously smart. One thing that people don't like, if they feel like they're listening to you and like, wow, that guy's smart, yeah, that's one thing. If they're looking at you and they feel like you are trying to show them how smart you are,
right,
that is something that people in life and wherever it is, that is where they push back.
Yeah.
And so that's where you can't get too self-indulgent and in love with the idea of your own intelligence, because that's not what the game is here, right? Like, the game is to be able to relate to people. And if you have smart things to say,
right,
you want to do that, like smart better than not smart. I think right, generally people would agree upon that. But the intelligence of it can't be like self-referential.
Well, and I think tone and how you say things is also a factor. I know for me, I was always I was never a huge Bob Costas fan, which is blasphemy in this industry.
Yes.
I mean, you say that, and I remember I wrote it once on SI.com 100 years ago, and I didn't have the cachet that I sort of built up over the years, and I remember just, you know, the looks I would get from people just so disgusted if you don't, you know, bow down to the altar of Bob Costas. But it was always, I always got the impression from him that it was, I'm smarter than you, let me tell you how you should feel about it. And it wasn't so much the words he said, I mean, I understood it, it was more about the way he said it. Yeah. And it always, to me, came across as, I am smarter than you. That's what it always, yeah, maybe I'm wrong, that's how it came across to me. So I don't even think it's the words and as much as the tone, like you just said.
And I think, like with Costas, I think we always have to remember about him because he's been doing this for so long
right,
that you forget. I guess Bob Costas is probably about 65 or something.
It
like
is
this.
Crazy because he doesn't look his age either.
No, and he was in his his mid-20s doing really big time stuff in his early 30s. And I think that when you're young, you can feel that need to prove yourself in this space. And he got to those places so fast that means that, yeah, I mean, there was some like on the ground, like, you know, dues paying of sorts that take place with Bob Costas, certainly. But I can only imagine that if I'm him and I get to this place and I'm like 27 years old, why am I here? Well, the reason you're here, obviously, is that you're really, really bright, right? And so if this is the reason why I'm here, I'm going to show you that I am really, really bright. I went through that, I guess, when I first got to college, and that was what I figured my hook was going to be, and I learned very quickly that people did not like that.
It
did not take long before I realized that me just trying to validate my existence was kind of invalidating the existences of other people. And so there's a thin line between expressing your opinion with confidence and telling people how they're supposed to feel.
Yeah, and it's also one of those things where I feel like if you're in this business, I've said this before, I had a whole big thing on this podcast last year. I had Jim Nance on, and I thought he gave me a phenomenal interview. I thought it was great. He sort of changed my opinion of him a little bit. And then I got a lot of feedback from people thinking he was a little arrogant on it. And there's a part of me that believes, though, if you're in this business, if you're someone who's on TV, if you're on the radio, there is you inherently have a little bit of arrogance. I mean,
yeah, to believe that you can do this in the first place, right?
To have the balls to just act like people care about your opinion and what you say, and to go into this business, there is a little bit of arrogance there, no matter who you are. I feel like
there's. Even if arrogance is not the word,
right?
Like we know the space that you're talking about there. And yeah, that's going to exist to a degree. You have to you probably are going to need to feel like there's some importance to your opinion to do this in this particular space.
Right.
And so it's always going to be that thin line that comes on that. The thing I think that's changed, though, over time is the internet. You know, people make the argument that the internet has kind of democratized a lot of these things, which is partially true. But what I think has really happened with the internet is the internet has made these things into much more of a conversation. And so it is beyond, people are not looking to you as much to be an authority as they used to. They do, I mean, there's a value if you are legitimately a person of authority, there's a value there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that people appreciate now that you can ask them what they know or whatever it is. Like, one thing I learned very quickly in doing national coverage was the people who follow a team locally know that team better than I ever will parachuting in. Like, I got some general ideas and I can tap into what's going on in all these other places. But like, if we're talking about University of Florida football, there's a whole bunch of people on the street that know way more about Florida football than I do. And right. It would stand to reason that I need to ask them some questions about what's going on with that. And so when I feel like I know something like that, I'm going to express it like I know it. When you don't, especially in this era of the internet, it is okay to say, this is something I don't really know.
Well, that I think that's sort of the thing that's we still need work on. There are so many, you know, I'm blown away by how it seems like every single person has an opinion on every single thing. And yeah. It's like, and I feel like I'm a very opinionated person, but even when the whole thing was going down a couple, you know, the past couple of weeks with the NBA, China, LeBron, I was sitting there like, I'm amazed that nobody sits there and says to themselves, you know what? I'm going to sit this one out. Maybe I'll let some other people handle this one. I mean, I know I didn't tweet about it just because, you know, sometimes it's okay to not weigh in on a subject, but I don't think enough people realize that.
Let me tell you what happened with me on that one. Yeah. After Daryl, I think Daryl sent that thing started blowing up on Saturday, and then it kind of got to full bloom on a Sunday, and then we get into work on Monday. And so I realized in talking about it, it wasn't just simply like, I don't know anything about the Hong Kong protests. I was like, yo, I don't know anything about Hong Kong. Like, what I know about Hong Kong is that it was returned to the Chinese in 1997. Right. That was like the one thing I knew. So I said, okay, cool. Let me just run through the wiki, see what I can get on the history of Hong Kong. And I was just going through, like, you know, from the Opium Wars and all this stuff, just like the transition of the territory. And I was like, whoa, I really don't know very much about this. Then I went and read and like checked out a primer on the protests themselves. And my standard on those sorts of things is, can I handle follow-up questions? Because if I can't handle follow-up questions, I'm not going to get out here. Because right. If somebody hits me with something that is reasonable to ask as a result, and my response is, I don't know, that's probably not the space I need to be in. So like the things that I felt like I could talk about, I will always talk about with the caveat of I don't know.
Right.
Like the things that I don't know. Like the trickiest thing to me about the Hong Kong one was none of us have a great handle on Chinese public opinion, you know? And so you'd have a lot of people who would make the argument that, you know, so the owner of the Nets, Tsai, put the thing out saying this is damaging to the Chinese people. And they're like, well, you know, that's what the government is saying. And I'm like, I can totally believe that that's what the government is saying. I don't have any counterfactual on this, right? What I know about this is we're talking about what is, in effect, a separatist movement from a larger nation. And very rarely is the general population on board with somebody like separating themselves from it. That's just that leaves me like a hypothesis or something I can figure out, but I don't know anything about what's going on here, and I'm not going to get forced into acting like I do.
Right. And we saw what happened with LeBron, obviously, which in and of itself, that was fascinating to see, because I thought there was a lot of fake faux outrage there with people who already didn't like LeBron, had a bone to pick with. You know, there are, I realized this, you know, over the past few years. I don't know. I'm naive sometimes. I'm in my own little bubble. And I just assumed like everyone has this respect for LeBron, loves LeBron. I mean, and then, you know, you get on Twitter and the big knock on LeBron is of the way he complains with the refs, which is just comical, because give me one NBA player who doesn't complain with the refs. But I definitely feel like there are people, and it's a decent amount, which is sad. They were waiting for LeBron to do something where they can get him.
Yeah, I think there's that, but I also think that people were looking for a justification for why they don't care about black people getting killed by the police, right? Like that, I think, is a huge part of what happened. So when the China thing came, you know, he was one that was kind of on the, I need to get more information.
Well, but he also said about people should think about what they tweet.
Right.
Ramifications.
But see, to me, that was something that was completely separate. That was a player management dispute where that came down, because the guys that went over for Team USA had been told, this is a thing that we're not going to talk about because this is a lightning rod issue. And then all of a sudden, this cat comes out here and talks about it. And then the players are the ones who have to pay for it ultimately. And LeBron's like, all right, so what you guys going to do about this guy? Because you know you would have done something about us, right? And then he says the thing about Maury being misinformed or whatever. That parroted so much of the language that comes on the other side of arguments that LeBron would typically make. But 12-year-old boy named Tamir Rice got killed by the cops in Cleveland. I want to say it was 2013 or 14. It was somewhere in there. It came to LeBron and asked LeBron about that. LeBron said, I do not have enough information on this. I am not going to discuss it. I don't live in Cleveland, and I had enough information about that to discuss it. The same people that are getting on LeBron now and being like, why aren't you saying something? Not a single one of them was there to be found when he wasn't talking about what was going on in his, in his backyard. He could wear the I Can't Breathe shirt when he comes here to the Barclays Center and does that, right? But then when it came back home and something that's happening right there and seemed to be similarly egregious, if you're of the belief that what happened was egregious, nobody had a problem with the fact that LeBron didn't say anything about this. So when people came and doubled back and they're like, well, now I'm not going to take you seriously when you talk about people being killed by the police. I'm like, so who do you take seriously in these moments? And that's what that was the backlash that I think that he got caught up in. It didn't really have that much to do with China as much as once you have asked us to care about these black people being killed by the police, you are now obligated to care about literally every single oppressed person in the world. And I don't think LeBron doesn't care about the people in Hong Kong. I do think that LeBron cares about his money under these circumstances. Yeah. I also don't think that you got to jump in on every fight.
Right. Well, I agree with you 100% about what you said about the people who were ripping LeBron. It wasn't about China, and it wasn't about Hong Kong at all. I agree with you there.
I hadn't heard nobody say a word about this until this happened.
Right.
It wasn't like this was bubbling under the surface. You know, this is all happening, and then LeBron got into the middle of it. This wasn't a thing. By the way, I'm pretty sure them protests are still going on right now, and I don't hear nobody talking about it.
Oh, no. Now it comes and goes, and that's it. And I also think, and this is the problem with sort of the times we live in and where everything is, you know, just one way or the other, whereas, okay, let's say you don't like LeBron's comments about China. Fine. Let's say you don't like his comments about Daryl Moore. Fine. That doesn't negate everything he's done or will do because of those comments. That's the frustrating, the part that's what gets me is that now it's just, you know, everything he's done in the past doesn't matter, whatever he's going to do in the future, because you know he's going to keep up with his charitable endeavors. He's proven that over and over. And now what, we just throw it all away because you don't like his comments on this issue, which, I don't get that mentality.
Everything's binary. Like, one thing that is interesting to me about the social media space and the way that it's blown up is that there's more room for discussion, but there seems to be less room for nuance. And what seems to have happened is like all this stuff is kind of crowded out into a way where there's sides, right? Who's on this side? Who's on that side? And those sides are rigid. And so if for whatever reason you disagree with people that happen to be on one side of an issue, why you do so doesn't really seem to matter. But the other part is, if you feel one way about one issue, it is then assumed by many of those people that you will agree with them on every issue that happens to pop up. And in 280 characters, there's not a lot of room for whatever nuance might be there, unless you're willing to do like I used to be and bang out about 15 of these things to make sure that you understand it. But otherwise, it's just it's got to be one way or another. Like I said that, and I still contend this, I've never come across a topic in my line of work more intellectually challenging than everything that happened with Daryl Morey and China and Hong Kong and the NBA. There were so many different levels. Like, if you just want to be binary about the right and wrong of it, and I guess I can see where some people come from on that, then it does become easy. But like for the job I do in the world that I'm in, no, there's a lot of levels to be discussed on this. And it was fascinating to try to figure out where everything lies. And I have people telling me, oh, what is a cop out? It's complex to say that people should have free speech. I'm like, no. It's complex because we believe that people should have free speech, but have willingly done business with people who do not agree. And therefore, what respect do you have to have for their cultural norms? Mm-hmm. And what do you have to do in order to please them or not please them? How does this affect what happens in the United States? Are you basically importing Chinese values into American society? All these things that are really interesting if you want to get into like the depth of it. But instead, I think that people wanted to declare what side they were on.
Right. Yeah, it's again. It's okay to not have a take on it, which is it seems just the opposite of whatever. How the China story? How hard is that for you guys, you and Pablo, on High Noon? You know, there was a story that ESPN had sent a memo. People don't, you know, just cover it straight if you're on one of the shows. Is that does that get frustrating for you, where you want to go deeper on something like that but you can't? Or are you okay leaving it alone? What is it like, that process, when it's a story like that for you?
Yeah, I think if I was doing like full-time radio, I might look at it a little different than on television. Because the thing about television, man, we don't have time.
Yeah.
Right? Like I understood where a lot of people came from, where they were like, well, the least you could do is explain to people what the conflict is that is going on there. And I'm like, okay, so by the time I explain the conflict and then I explain what happened with Daryl Morey, after that 2 minutes and 30 seconds, like seriously, how many people are still watching on television? And right. Bill Withers with the great line, it don't do too much good to be talking, brother, if ain't nobody listening, right? So, you know, like the mechanics of television made it unwieldy in that way. I found, like I never saw this memo that was discussed. I know that it was basically it was no different than any other topic where they don't want you to get into like the politics of what it was. Or like we don't really want to get into Chinese politics. I didn't find it difficult to talk about this without talking about Chinese politics because I don't know anything about Chinese politics. It was very easy for me to not talk about Chinese politics in that way, but I didn't think that, for example, if you wanted to make the declaration that free speech should be sacrosanct and protected, that was not something that the company was going to come in and be like, hey, man, you in here talking about how you can't have free speech? Yeah, how you got to have free speech? Nobody was going to say anything like that. Like, I don't know if anybody, and maybe there's somebody that's there that really had something that they wanted to say that they got in trouble. I saw a couple people say some things where I was like, ooh, I don't think I would talk about that one right. That's not the comparison that I would make. And they didn't get in any trouble on it, you know?
Yeah. Do you ever see stuff? I mean, I know ESPN is, like I said, they want their talent sticking to sports. Obviously, I don't think it's any secret that you're more than just sports.
Yeah.
Do you have to sometimes put the phone away to make sure you don't tweet when Trump does something ridiculous? Do you have to, you know, sort of sit on your hands and make sure you don't get that temptation when, it happens because there's a part of me that thinks it's, you know, someone mentioned to me recently that they said, you don't tweet about Trump anymore. And I just said, you know, what's to say at this point? At this point, it's 900 ridiculous things a day. People have, you know, their feelings on it. You're not changing anyone's mind. I mean, yeah, every now and then where there's something that's so outrageous, you just want to say, like, I just can't believe what a dope is running the country. But what good does that accomplish at the end of the day? But I still can do it because that's why it won't do anything to me if I do it. You're in a different boat. So how difficult does it get every now and again?
For me, it doesn't because I tapped out on Trump in particular after he got the nomination, right? Okay. So like I would tweet about the debates when they had, you know, it seemed funnier then. Now the Democrats have 20 people out there. It doesn't seem as funny, but it was like 10, 12 people up there. And Trump is rolling up being like, Bobby Jindal is polling at 1%. I don't even know why he's here. Like, that's hilarious. Like, those are apolitical observations. Like, I would watch a debate and I would tweet about the funny things that were going on with the debate itself. I rarely, like, engaged in the politics of it. Mm-hmm. Then he got the nomination and it was just like, oh, okay, so this thing is very serious. I'm like, okay, I'm just kind of lay back on that. Then he became president and the truth was, I rarely would send things out about world issues just for the sake of saying that I did so. I really believe, and I mean, I believe now to a degree, I just don't think Twitter's a great place for it at this point. But I had something to contribute to the conversation. Like, I had something to offer. So when police shootings, like 2014, 15, when that was really big in the news and that was really, like, gaining steam, I felt I had a value that I could provide to the discussion. There is nothing that I can tell you about 2019 American politics that you can't figure out for yourself.
Right.
I'm not going to change your mind. I'm not going to illuminate anything for you. Like, when's the last time that you heard about somebody talking about Trump, reading about Trump, whatever it happened to be, and you were like, wow, that's something I hadn't thought of before? Because we're not in the weeds of nuance in talking about this and how it goes. So yeah, for me,
the only thing that takes me aback these days is when someone is taken aback by him. You know, like what he's done with Turkey and Syria and all that. And it's like, and you see people are outraged. It's like, wait a second. So you're surprised that the guy who did a reality show with Meatloaf and Gary Busey doesn't have strong foreign policy? Like, that, I'm taken aback by the shock of people's shock more than what he's doing. I expect what he's doing because he's incompetent and he's a reality show host and he's running the country. It's the people who are surprised by what goes on that takes me aback.
Yeah, no, there's, I mean, I don't know. Like, at this point with everything there in 2020, it's just going to be monstrous. Like, it's for everybody involved, this is not going to be fun.
Well, that's what I keep saying about your bosses who have the, you know, stick to sports policy is, you know, the ESPN PR team is going to be very busy, I think, in, like, you know, September, October, November leading up to that election, because I just feel like there's going to be some people are going to slip through the cracks there. And
yeah, I you know, I think, though, that for the most part, most people have kind of made a decision about how they are and how they are not going to handle these sorts of things. Yeah. I think part of what happened, and I don't think enough of this gets discussed, is that a lot of that politics stuff, it worked its way into the sports news cycle.
Yes.
Like, people didn't really have to reach to go find that. So, like, right. I, like, as a thought experiment, I've wondered this. If the Kaepernick thing happened in 2019, do we cover it any differently than we did in 2016? And my guess is that we don't, right? Like, I think all the stories wind up being the same. We haven't had anything that has really emerged since that story that was anything like it. Therefore, we don't know, as much as, you know, people say it's this whole new world order that's come up, I don't know if the world changed or if the stories changed.
And that was also the perfect storm. I mean, he was the first player who you ever saw kneel during the anthem. I think there was a lot of confusion and ignorance from people about why exactly he was, you know, right away it was about the flag, which it was never about.
Right.
Then Trump tweets about it. Other players join in. The NFL doesn't know what to do about it. So really, I think there was so many, like you said, if it happened now, I don't know if it all goes down the way it went down.
Yeah. Well, that also happened the last week of August,
right?
Which is the last week of us not having stuff to talk about. Like, I was on vacation that week.
Right.
I
remember what happened. Game.
Yeah. Like, it happened right there. I was not even at work when that went down. But, like, I think about, for example, Linsanity, right? The Jeremy Lin run of 2012. That week, like, when it was really going on, there was nothing happening. Like, this was right after the Super Bowl. Like, it's in between the Super Bowl and the All-Star game, which is the deadest time of the year.
Yeah.
If Lin had that happen and it really jumped off in the middle of December, we don't do this the same way, because
right.
the landscape has more things for us to talk about. But he was the biggest thing going. I remember I was in Bristol back when I was just getting on where I could get on. I was in Bristol when that Linsanity thing happened. Man, I did one show. I did four shows in one day. I remember that. And the topic everywhere I went was Jeremy Lin. And then Floyd Mayweather looked up and was like, ooh, attention. I will say that Jeremy Lin is only getting this attention because he is Asian. And then now we turn it into a Floyd Mayweather thing. Who the hell ever cared about what Floyd Mayweather thought about anything? He gets punched in the face for money. Like, nobody cares what his opinion is. But we had this airtime to fill up.
Yeah.
And so, like, this is kind of where it comes up. Like, if there was more actual football that was going on at the time of Kaepernick, do we cover it the same way? Like, I think there's all these variables that get lost in discussing this, and it just turned into something larger for people.
I love what your point here about timing on stories, and sometimes stories get bigger because of timing. And I was going through some of your tweets just in prep for the interview, and you tweeted about something that I thought would be a much bigger story. On this podcast last week, I had on Sports Illustrated legal analyst Mike McCann to discuss it, because I think it's a fascinating story, the Tyler Skaggs story.
Yeah.
I saw you tweeted about it in the last couple of days. I'm shocked. I mean, I'm shocked it's not a bigger story.
So let's
Because it's whack. It's wacky on every level.
Yeah, well, let's think about this, right? The 1980s, we had the Pittsburgh cocaine trials in baseball. We had the Edmonton Oiler cocaine scandal of the 1980s.
Keith Hernandez. Keith, oh, that was the Pirates, right?
Yeah,
was the
part, right. Yeah. And, of course, just generally speaking, the NBA and what went on there. The drug epidemic of the 1980s was cocaine. And so cocaine came and affected all these sports, and it was a big thing in all of them when these things happened. The drug of epidemic of this day are the opiates. Like, this is it. This is on the cover of Time magazine. Like, this is a huge political flashpoint. Like, this matters. This dude died of an overdose, apparently receiving these drugs from someone who works for the Angels. And from what I've read, apparently he's not the only dude on the team that has been abusing these things. Is this just that we don't care about baseball, or that we are steering clear of this kind of story? Or is it that the outlets don't have the resources to really go in and report on this necessarily? Like, it seems to be all together, but this seems like a huge scandal of brewing. The DEA is involved and nobody seems to care.
I could not agree more with you. I think it's going to sound harsh to say this, and I don't mean it the way it's going to sound, but I think the fact that it's baseball, it's a player who's, you know, was a D-list kind of guy.
Right.
Middle of football season. Story broke on a weekend, broke on a Saturday morning. You know, if this is another, you know, if this is a Bryce Harper, I would imagine it's a bigger story. If this is anyone in the NFL or the NBA, it's probably a bigger story.
Right.
Maybe it gets another run when those other names come out, because they said there's four or five players. I know there's a report they interviewed Matt Harvey. But like you said, you have a PR guy supplying and doing the drugs with the pitcher, and there's story barely got in. I mean, and you guys, ESPN, did a phenomenal job reporting it out. There were some follow-ups.
Right.
I was surprised it didn't have more legs.
I also think part of it, though, is people don't see this opioid abuse as being immoral, right? Like, I think that people view it as, hey, man, people get, you know, people have these surgeries, they have these medical issues, and then they get caught on this stuff, and then they can't get out. You know, like, what you will see when this all happens with baseball is they are going to treat this very humanely. Like, yeah. They're going to treat this humanely in a way that we didn't really see. Like, we saw in basketball, man, they were throwing people out the league left and right, two-year bans. You know, not even really thinking about it. You're not going to see something like this here, because I think that there's a much more human view to who the opiate user is and how we should treat it. And people understand, you know, how this sort of things happen. So maybe that's it, right? Like, are we ill-equipped to talk about a drug scandal if we don't have an obvious villain? Like, is that what it is? So, like, Len Bias, even in death, he was not created as a villain. I think in a lot of ways people saw him as a martyr of what the times were, but you could still point at him and be like, bad Len, you did this to yourself. Yeah. And people don't really look at the pill stuff in the same way. And so, yeah. Like, maybe that's what it is. Maybe they're just not a good enough team. Like, I can't figure out what all the variables are that are in play that have turned this into something that's just kind of skating.
Yeah, yeah. To me, it's one of the wildest stories I've ever heard, and surprised it hasn't gotten more traction.
Yeah, I'd say this Major League Baseball is like, no, this is exactly the way that we would prefer it.
I do think the story will have another run. It's far from over. That story is far from over. So I do think it'll have another run. When you're doing High Noon and you have the podcast as well, The Evening Jones, what is your favorite thing to talk about?
Oh, generally speaking,
Perfect World for Bomani Jones is discussing what?
Oh, music.
Music.
I mean, if music paid better, I never would have stopped.
Right.
Like, that was the thing I did. I enjoy, like, if you want to see me light up or somebody bring it up, it's like, okay, if we can get into a good, like, historical sort of music discussion, I am here for that. Yeah. Like, I do, but just to be clear, still really, really enjoy talking about sports. Like, I still find sports have not bored me. There's certain ways of talking about sports that I can find to be boring. Like, we are kind of sometimes, give me the number one, the number two, the number three, the number four. Like, you know, sometimes we're doing that. Oh, coach got fired. Okay, cool. Well, we got a list of ways that we go about doing that. But no, you get me in here talking about some music, here for it.
Yeah.
Here for it.
Would people be like, do you like all kinds of music?
Oh, yeah, I'm all over.
Is there any genre you won't listen to?
You know, it's funny. I would have told you that, like, my one that I don't do is country, and that is still generally the case. And then I got on this last Sturgill Simpson album, and now I'm in that rabbit hole.
I keep seeing tweets about this. From Chris Long, who I follow on Twitter, is a big... And Russillo, they're always tweeting. And Van Pelt. And
so this last album is kind of an interesting, like, country, lo-fi, Pink Floyd sort of hybrid. Yeah. So, like, if you look... Like, my Morning Jacket stuff from like 03 to 05 is very similar to what he's doing on this record. But then I went back into some of the stuff that's probably more straight ahead country than that one. And the songwriting is just monstrous. I was like, oh, okay, I can do this. And I just generally do not like the sound of country music.
Me too. Yeah.
Like, that's just generally, and I grew up in Texas. So it's not like I never had an opportunity to get familiar. And it's not like I just reject any country song that you put in front of me. That's my new one. I can find you a couple. I can find you a few.
Even like that Old Town Road, I saw all these tweets. I'm like, I've never heard this song. And then I heard it. I'm like, this is what people are going crazy about. I don't get it.
I have to say that one, I had to come around. Because at first I was like, this is going to be the new Ice Ice Baby. And then after a while I was like, okay, this is kind of jamming a little bit. It's rather unremarkable in some ways, but it kind of rides.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't do it for me, but what was the last concert you went to?
What is the last? Oh, I went to see Stevie Wonder at Red Rocks in June.
That had to be good.
It was
like, how can a Stevie Wonder concert not be good?
Well, his voice was a little bit weak. He wasn't feeling so
really?
Well.
Yeah,
feeling well. Like, I've seen him before, and he is maybe the best live singer I've ever seen, just in terms of power and taking care of his voice. But what was funny was that Usher came, probably for the same reason I did as Stevie at Red Rocks, and then they asked Usher to kind of, Stevie's having a hard time here, help him out a little bit. But Usher didn't really know the words to the songs, so Stevie's trying to feed Usher the words on the microphone, you know, over time. I am building. My Castle of Love. And at one point, Usher goes, you talk too fast. Then Usher was just like, okay, so this ain't going to work. I'm just going to dance on the piano. Right? If I can't get all these songs right, I'm just going to dance on the piano.
Do what you do best.
Yeah, man.
Do
like, you do hey, best. Mate, that was the Hail Mary.
So it was because Stevie was under the weather, though.
Yes.
It's not like the voice is gone.
No. Okay, he was under the weather.
All right. Yeah, he's like at the top of my list of people I haven't seen.
But don't get me wrong, it was still Monster. Like, even with him under the weather, it's still Stevie Wonder songs, right? It's still the band that Stevie Wonder is going to show up.
I have this dream that, so they already announced that Eddie Murphy's going to be hosting Saturday Night Live in December.
Yes.
And I'm praying there's like another skit with him and Stevie, because when he did a skit with Eddie when Eddie hosted in 81 or whatever, 84. No. 81, I think.
He was still on the cast.
Yeah, and they did the My Sharia Moore, and it's just, it was great. So I'm hoping for like a little Stevie cameo surprise on SNL.
Can you imagine everybody that's trying to call in a favor to try to be there that night Eddie is going to be there?
I'm a huge Eddie Murphy fan from, I think we're on Delirious. I think Delirious is the single greatest comedy thing I've ever seen created in my life. So I'm I'm curious now in this time to see how he does it and what the comeback is like. Because obviously there are some issues with what Delirious was. I think it's a little overrated. I think there's a few minutes in the beginning there, obviously, that would not fly today. But the gist of it, the ice cream man and the cookout, and that all still holds up.
When's the last time you watched Delirious?
Oh, when he did the Comedians in Cars with Jerry, like a month ago. I went and rewatched it. Probably a month ago, or two months ago.
I did the same thing. Yeah. It was very interesting to go back and watch and evaluate. Because, yes, the beginning, you cannot do. And sometimes women get mad at you if you slap her.
Right.
Oh, yeah, we're not doing that anymore, Stevie. But what I found fascinating in going back and watching it was really understanding the anatomy of why it is that Eddie could be so successful. And part of it was, because Eddie basically, he never had to be the black dude, right? Like, he was obviously the black dude, but, you know, like all those movies he's doing, Beverly Hills Cop and everything else, like he never had to do any like Chilling Circuit type of thing. But like, you think about like the Bus Boys are the band when he comes out there, the references and stuff like to the Honeymooners and everything else, because people only had five channels at that point growing up, all the frames of reference were basically the same.
Yeah.
You know, so he'll throw some stuff about Teddy Pendergrass and all that stuff, right? But basically, he was telling very median jokes, like like middle America knew what Eddie Murphy was talking about with all of these jokes, and that I think is actually harder to do now because there are so many fewer things that we all watch,
right?
But he could explain to people, and this is like, for me, producing content is always an interesting trick, how to make it clear to people that we have more in common than you think. And that was the thing that he was so brilliant at.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that there's not a person in the world who can't relate to that ice cream man bit. I mean, and the cookout and the mother throwing the shoe. And it was all, and even in Raw, going to the movies, and I'm Italian, so when he talks about the Italians after Rocky. It's just, it was phenomenal. I mean, I can't wait for this comeback and to see how he pulls it off. I think he will. But it was interesting because if you watch the Comedians in Cars with Jerry Seinfeld, did you?
Yeah.
He does seem very, tortured is a strong word. I'll use it, but it's a little strong. But he does seem a little tortured about the stuff in Delirious that doesn't hold up today. You could see this conflict about it with him. At least that's me playing pop psychologist watching that interview with Jerry.
I was talking to a friend of mine in the business, and I don't want to say his name because I don't know if he wants this like to be public, but he's like, the book he wants to write is the book on Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
But he's like, I don't have the sources. Like, he doesn't have the people to get him what the real story is, because it is the most fascinating Hollywood career really that anybody has ever had. I mean, he did all that stuff before he was 25.
Two stand-up specials and That's it.
Two stand-up specials. Walter Waite had those big blockbusters, right? So 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places. You get the Beverly
Coming
Hills Cop,
America.
Too. Golden Child, right? Coming to America.
Nutty Professor is even.
Yeah. But the interesting stop in between is Boomerang, which is
good movie.
It is underrated. It's a great romantic comedy. But for him, it's like the blackest movie in the world. Like, it was just black people all on the crew, like everywhere else. And if you go read the review that the New York Times did of that movie, it was savage to the point where he took out a full page ad, if I'm not mistaken, like to refute it, because he had taken that power. Like, he had gotten to where he wanted to go, and he took the power in a way. And you notice after that is when we start getting Shrek, right? After that is when we start getting the Nutty
Daddy
Professor.
Doolittle.
Right. That's when we get all that stuff. I think he decided, it was like, all right, fine. If y'all ain't gonna let me do it the way I want to do it, I'll just get these checks.
Well, And I think everything, too, that he did was totally conscious. I don't think he's a guy who got, you know, his business manager wanted him to do this, his agent wanted him to do this. I think Eddie made all those choices.
I agree.
For Eddie.
I bet. The Dolomite movie is very good, by the way.
I've heard. You saw it?
Yes.
Oh, okay, because I've heard nothing but good things.
Yeah, they did a limited run in theaters before it gets on the Netflix, yeah. And it is a... It is kind of interesting if you've seen Dreamgirls. And by the way, I'm not a huge movie person, but we just happen to be in the stuff I actually know something about. Dreamgirls, it's very much like, in some ways, if the character from Dreamgirls doesn't get strung out on heroin, right? Like, it's very much that guy. But right. the story is very much a, I want the world to know my name kind of story. And he captured kind of almost a naivete of Rudy Ray Moore in a way that was interesting.
I'm looking very forward to that. That and Tom Hanks' Mr. Rogers. Those are the two movies I'm going to make sure I go see before the, you know, when they come out.
I would love to like rewrite a Mr. Rogers movie that just has Mr. Rogers like shooting dice and all these other things. Like things, you know, like Mr. Rogers walks off set and unzips that sweater and then turns into a completely different person.
Well, that was Eddie, Mr. Robinson's name.
Yes,
basically.
That would be but like ESPN did that commercial with John Clayton years ago where he gets off the set. Like that's the Tom Hanks Mr. Rogers movie I want to make.
That would be outstanding. Let's bring it back to the business a little bit. I'm just curious, TV, podcast, radio, what do you have a favorite? Is there if you had to only do one, what would you do?
Nothing has ever felt more natural than radio.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if I would want to do a 3-hour-a-day, 5-day-a-week radio show again because I didn't realize how much energy I was expending doing that until I stopped.
Yeah.
But nothing, and actually to be particular, nothing has ever felt more natural than local radio where you could turn on the phone lines and you like you make friends. Like when I stopped doing my local show in Raleigh, and that was like, I was real hard a couple of days.
I don't want to cut you off, but just give me a little, as a New Yorker here, give me a little lowdown on Raleigh. Is it all North Carolina basketball? Is it?
It is.
Break it down like what they talk about there.
It is ACC.
Okay.
More than anything else. Like, you got a decent taste. Like, you can talk NFL. You know, when things come up, you can do it. But it's more ACC than it is particular to UNC. Because Raleigh, right, state's in Raleigh. UNC's in Chapel Hill, Durham's in Duke,
right,
and you know, I mean, Duke's in Durham, and Duke has a smaller fan base than all of them and all this stuff. So, like, ACC basketball comes around, we always got something to talk about.
Yeah.
2008 ACC football, ooh, how are we going to make this work? but when I was there, like, you really kind of make friends with those people, and you have a very intimate relationship with them. If they listen to you 2-3 hours a day, man, they'll listen to nobody else in their lives, no 2-3 hours a day. And like, it was people really calling up, crying on the way out and everything else, because it all really felt that sincere. There are people who used to listen to those shows that I'm legitimately like hang out with, friends to this day, based on that. And you can't get that on television.
Yeah.
You can maybe get it on a podcast on a small scale, but you can't. Nothing ever felt more human than doing local radio.
Mm-hmm. And do you not? So, where do you stand with radio now? Is it because the TV show takes up most of your time?
Yeah. Well, when we were coming around to do the television show, I wanted to. There's a couple things. One, I wanted to kind of focus more attention on doing that.
Right.
The other part of it was, so I move here. My producer is working out of Bristol. Right. I'm over at the ESPN New York. Studios, sitting in there by myself for 3 hours a day trying to do a radio show. And that's not the way a radio show is meant to be done, right? Like any energy or whatever has going, I got to generate it, like gin it up all here by myself in doing that. And it just really wasn't a great allocation of my time at that point. And at that time, we thought there was a legitimate facilities issue, whether or not I would be able to do both things from the same place. Because if I couldn't do them both from the same place, then that just wasn't something that I was going to do. And so, and the other thing was, I wanted to, a podcast is different than doing a radio
show.
Right? It's a whole different animal in doing it. And I wanted to explore the space of doing a fully produced podcast. Like, I do The Evening Jones, but that's just me taking questions from the audience and then we slap the audio up on the internet. Like, the product that we put out now for the right time as a podcast is a totally distinct product from the one that we put out on the radio. So now when I do interviews, I'm not trying to figure out how to squeeze an interview into a 10-minute block on the radio.
Right.
Now I got all this time. Now I don't have to necessarily do something in sports. Now if I want to talk to a musician, I can do that. If somebody's written a book that I find to be interesting, I can go ahead and I can do those things. And so there's a freedom that comes from doing it in this way.
Do you love doing interviews? Do you love interviewing people?
I am getting better at it.
Yeah.
I didn't get into this to ask people questions. I got into this to talk.
Right. All right?
I didn't get into this to find out what y'all was talking about. That was ridiculous.
Right.
But especially after working with Dan, like, I was not confident in myself as an interviewer. And it was something that I really, really did want to get better at. Mm-hmm. And so I had 4 years to kind of study at the hand of the master in doing that. And then when we came to this podcast, that was a big thing I wanted to do. I wanted to get better at doing interviews. And now I've come to really, really enjoy doing them. Like, especially when I got somebody in person, like, I like being able to sit across from somebody and realize, like, when, not when I've gotten them, but like once I realize, okay, we've developed this sort of rapport that they trust me enough that I can ask a question that I might not have asked, you know, even 5 minutes ago in the course of doing that. And so I do get a particular satisfaction when I'm like, okay, now we're on the right track with this and now we can put it on, because that's not a natural part of, like, getting into people's business is not a natural part of my life.
Okay.
So this isn't something that just comes easy to me. And so for me personally, I don't know how much people enjoy the interviews necessarily, but I am personally very happy with the improvement that I think that I've shown in that area.
I do. You mentioned Dan Le Batardi. I love the way he does interviews. I love that they're different. I mean, I think anything in this business, I think there's a reason why you stand out. Mm-hmm. In this business, it's about being different. If you're different, I think that's what people are drawn to more than anything. And Dan's interviews, if you know people aren't familiar with them, he does not ask the same generic questions that every interviewer asks.
Well, he's willing to run the risk of disaster,
right?
Which is what I am not willing to do. Like, if an interview is not going well on the radio after 3 minutes, I'll bail.
Yeah.
Not Dan. Dan is about to some way, one way or another, he is going to ask this big monstrous question. You know, tell me the most miserable moment in your life. I'm not built like that, but he can do it, and he can get amazing stuff out of it because he's willing to roll the dice on the other end for when they want to go tell him what he can do with himself.
Right. Well, that's the thing. He also doesn't care about, well, I shouldn't say he doesn't care about, but he will push the envelope with ESPN, and that helps too, as we saw.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree. I would stop short of saying he doesn't care, but I don't know how much he does.
Right.
Like, there's no, but he also doesn't care. Like, he is, I didn't come up like as a newspaper journalist. So there's, and I don't say this to knock Dan, this is just overall, I don't have the kind of self-importance that a lot of these cats have about their questions and what they want to ask or whatever it is. But there's a confidence that comes from believing I am the newspaper man and people have to answer my questions that he possesses, that he then takes with him. And it's like, I'm going to ask these people whatever it is. And if they aren't with it, fine.
Right.
And I'm not good at that last part.
I'm going to ask you a weird question, but I'm curious. Let's say something happens and you're no longer at ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ever work at FS1?
Probably. Like, I mean, I don't, I'm trying to think of like where I just absolutely 100% could not work.
Right.
Like, FS1 employs a person or two that I don't like.
Just two?
Off the top of my head. A person
or two. You're nicer than me.
A person or two. So, well, not like, for example, when Skip worked at ESPN, I was pretty good with Skip.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't have anything bad to say.
Well, about. I don't even mean it from a personal standpoint, because I will say I have, for the most part, I always hear that Skip's a good guy.
Yeah.
I'm mainly just talking about the programming, the tactics, the obvious way they try to get attention. And I've had this battle with people on Twitter, so let me just say this if anyone out there is listening, because yes, ESPN does have a couple of hot take shows during the day, obviously, but there is no comparison between ESPN and what FS1 does during the day. I'm not talking about at night when they have games, but their day, I'm saying this not Bomani, but their daytime shows are, in my opinion, problematic.
Well,
but
this is
that's what, me saying this, not Bomani.
But this is what I would say on that front. One of my very good friends in this industry is Nick Wright. We watch football together every Sunday.
Yeah, I don't get that Nick Wright over there. It's a weird fit.
Yeah, but see, but that's
free
the thing.
Nick Wright. Right,
but I was about to say, but Nick is very happy over there.
Yeah.
Like, he enjoys working over there. And Nick is, in terms of like politics and sensibilities, probably a bit more. He is farther in the direction that people assume that I am in, mm-hmm. right? And he's good. He seems to really enjoy it. He likes working over there. You know, a lot of people that work over there too used to work at ESPN.
Right.
You know, so like, not that I'm like actively campaigning for a job or anything like that, but I don't, look, if something happened and I didn't have a job,
right.
I'm trying to think of who these people are that I won't listen to. Like if I'm sitting here, I want to be very specific about these circumstances in case my boss isn't listening.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm sitting somewhere with no job and Fox calls, I am going to answer. You know, I don't know what's going to happen after it, but I will pick up the phone.
All right. I just wanted to make sure. Last thing before we wrap. I'm just curious. So high noon, you and Pablo every day, ESPN, 4 o'clock. ESPN or ESPN?
We're on ESPN.
ESPN. I'm one of these people, like, I don't even know the difference between ESPN and ESPN. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, it's one of the, when people say, like, oh, it's on ESPN2 instead, like, a game, I'm like, oh, what's the difference? It's the same thing. So you and Pablo every day, high noon, 4 o'clock. You're not a hot take show at all. So let's give me, before we wrap, give me Bomani Jones's hottest hot take right now. Any topic, sports, food, music, anything. Give me, what's your hottest take right now?
Well, you may not know this, but I will walk you through a little story of my history and time. So the first time I ever thought about doing anything in broadcast was me and my buddy George in college. People like, I went to school that had a real strong mass media program, Clark Atlanta University, and there were people that were like, yo, we want to do a TV show with you guys. We're like, what do you want us to do? Like, we just want to watch you guys talk. Like, that's all they wanted. We never did it, but that's all they wanted. And some of the things that we would talk about, I could see in retrospect why they might have wanted to do a show with us. And one topic of discussion we had was whether or not Stevie Wonder was actually blind.
Yes.
Now I want to walk you through the steps on this, right?
I've seen you do this on Twitter, and it gets me irate.
And by the way, I haven't done it in years, right? I just want to walk you through it, right? I don't even understand why it makes you upset. I want Stevie to be able to see. You want Stevie
Here's
to be blind.
Why it makes me upset. Because of the idiots on Twitter who will then carry on this conspiracy.
See, to me, I don't think it's so much a conspiracy. So I'm just saying.
Okay.
So we had just come up with our case, what it is. Just a few too many references to colors. You have to remember, Ray Charles went blind when he was 7 years old. Stevie, as they say, went blind in the incubator. But the man could write the song. She's a girl in a dream. There's a four-eyed cartoon monster on the TV screen. Takes another puff and says it's a crazy dream. And red is green. And she's a tangerine. What you know about any of that, Stevie? Right? Like what is your frame of reference on any of these matters? I don't know if you've seen like some of the women that Stevie been around in the course of time, but apparently he was rolling sevens in the dark, pulling some bad ones without having any idea that was what it was that he was doing. It was some pretty amazing stuff, right?
I can't believe I'm allowing this theory on my podcast.
I'm just laying it out for you, yeah. Right? And then we thought about it, and you know, generally speaking, when people are blind, the instruments they tend to play is stuff like, you know, the guitar, right? Right? Stevie don't play the guitar. Stevie does play the drums. You don't hear that much about blind people playing the drums. And then we're like, wow, you sure got an eye for color? All this other stuff. We're like, huh, what is this? And so I started doing TV, doing Around the Horn. And I mentioned this on the Behind the Horn segments.
Is that where it got
started?
I mentioned it
Behind the Horn on the YouTubes. And I had a hashtag on Twitter, Stevie Ain't Blind. I just thought it was facetious.
Oh, I remember. Yeah.
But what wasn't supposed to happen was I wasn't supposed to become famous. This was just supposed to be something that me and my friends talked about because it was funny. And then I took what me and my friends talked about into the public space. And then after that, it became a thing. And then I had people who were referring to me as a truther and the likes. And I kind of wanted to retreat from it because I didn't, you know, I thought people were taking it in a way that I did not intend. But then after that, I saw that video with Stevie catching that microphone before it fell down to the ground.
Oh, my.
And all I'm saying is, I am not saying that Stevie Wonder is not blind. I'm saying I won't be surprised if I find out that Stevie Wonder is not blind. Like if I were to walk in here right now and Stevie Wonder was just throwing a tennis ball off the wall and catching it, I'd be like, sounds about right.
I am shocked that ESPN, with all of their power and, you know, can promote anything and do anything, that they have not had Stevie and you do something together.
Well, I'm afraid it'll be like Eddie Murphy. Stevie came up to me and said, he said that about me again.
Right, right.
I'm going to whoop your behind. And then I'm going to have to fight Stevie.
Right,
and
right.
Let me tell you, like, if I got into a fight with Stevie Wonder, I can't think of anything that would make me less welcome at the places that I find to be important than the idea that I
do think Stevie should come on High Noon and sort of address this and you know, give him a chance to for a rebuttal at least. But
let me throw something else at you.
Yeah,
my guy Lance Gilliam, he handles all my stuff behind the scenes.
Okay.
Great man. He once sold Stevie 4 big screen TVs, top of the line. No line. Top of the line. Top of the line. And my thing is, why do you,
why do you need a big, right?
And why do they got,
what difference is Stevie's watching a 13-inch or a 50-inch, right?
How about this? Why Stevie be getting courtside seats? But you, but like I'm just saying, you gotta admit, that's kind of greedy, right? You can sit what row behind? Does he just love to feel the bounce that much?
I just remembered the great Eddie line from that, when Eddie's like, I don't think you're that talented. I don't think you're all that. You want to impress me? Take the wheel, MF.
Take the wheel. But here's the thing. He say you want to impress me, take the wheel.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, Stevie going to be leaning to the left with one arm out the window, just grooving down the PCH. I mean, now again, I'm not saying that Stevie Wonder is not blind. That is not what I'm saying. But if you were to ask me a hot take.
Doesn't get any hotter than that. That's for sure. It's also a perfect way to end this podcast, but I still think Jimmy Pitaro, someone over there, better get Stevie on one of these shows and let him and Bomani have a segment.
I think I actually might have messed it up for everybody trying to get Stevie.
You know what? You guys could. It would be perfect. Have him perform at the ESPYs, and then you guys can do something.
It's about time for a Stevie halftime show. They're running low. They're running low on acts that everybody likes.
Exactly. Yeah. No one's complaining about Stevie. All right. I thank you for coming in. I enjoyed this conversation a lot. Bomani Jones, ESPN High Noon, Monday through Friday, 4 o'clock with Pablo Torre, and. Appreciate you giving me the time.
No, man, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. And that wraps up with Bomani. All right, my thanks to Bomani Jones. Thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. It was all over the place, which I enjoy. Covered a lot of topics, and very, very good stuff there from Bomani. High Noon every day on ESPN, 4 o'clock with Pablo Torre. Check it out. And always check out the SI Media Podcast. If you can, subscribe. Rate, review, it helps tremendously. Subscribing, most important, please do that. Really helps a lot. And we'll see you next week right here on the SI Media Podcast. Take care.